Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and on to changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a design leadership coach, service design and innovation consultant, educator and writer. My guest today is Dr. Piers Ottoglia-Gordon, an innovation catalyst, researcher, facilitator and evaluator based in Botswana. Piers is impassioned by the space between transformation and liberation and researches the complexity, evaluation and emergence of design and innovation across the world. He's built mixed method research designs for Fortune 500 companies, directed design and evaluation strategies for six-figure clients, built and consulted on social change curricula in design, evaluation and equity across four continents, as well as co-designing equity design products, papers and services with international change makers. Piers, welcome to Power of 10.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I think we know each other because, well, I first came across you in Cheryl Kababa's book, Closing the Loop, all about kind of systems thinking for designers. And there was a nice, you're one of the expert people in there who wrote a piece, or kind of had an interview in there with her. And she was on Power of 10 just recently. And I think probably that's how we kind of connected on LinkedIn.
Something like that. There's so many different ways that our worlds like engage with each other, you know?
Collide, exactly. So I'm always interested in, you know, I just read quite a sort of long, complex bio, actually. You've got lots of different things going on, but I can kind of see there's some patterns here. Tell me a little bit about your journey from wherever it's been to where you are now.
Wherever it's been. Okay, I get to start it. Exciting. Mm. I usually like to start this story by talking about video games. Can I start there?
Yeah, you can start there. I'm fascinated by that.
Sure. Depending on who you talk, I'm a youngin' or I'm an olden. My first experience with, being addicted to, video games and video game community was when, at 9 years old, on my birthday, I got a Nintendo 64. To some, that's too old. For some, it's like, of course, come on, Atari. That's my first experience, right?
You're young to me.
Hey, it's all good. We have our own background experiences. And the two games that really like engaged with my identity were Super Mario 64 and Legend of Zelda: Ocarina of Time. I'm currently playing Tears of the Kingdom on Nintendo Switch.
The new one.
So it is deep in my psyche, in my soul, to be a part of those identities. And additionally, a little bit later, the game was Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. Invested me into becoming a skateboarder for a little bit of time until I broke my shoulder. But these experiences, I realized over my professional career, made me grapple with the identity that really resonated. It is being a discoverer. These interactive narratives that we play, that's why people get so invested in video games in the first place, get you to identify with the main character, what they're trying to accomplish and what they can do while on the way. And what they do is journey. They learn a lot of great new people. They go across the plane, engaging and connecting with secrets, and sometimes they beat a big bad, but the point here is that you get the ability to engage with a massive collection of knowledge that you hold and leverage to your benefit. If that means, for me, traveling on my skateboard all across the city where I'm from, Ellicott City, Maryland, by the way, with folks that I loved and appreciated and found new places to make mistakes on kickflips and do all these different activities. And that became endemic to how I saw not only what I liked to do as a preteen and as a human, but in my professional life, how I navigated my professional career, meaning I've done a lot of weird things. Had a lot of weird professional shifts. For instance, undergrad, got 2 degrees, applied physics and aerospace engineering. And then I shifted into an interdisciplinary PhD program where my fields are innovation practice, evaluation capacity building, and international development.
So you started as a rocket scientist.
Yes. Is that what you're saying? It is a thing. I have a lot of feeling.
So you get to actually say, hey, you know.
I did get trained in that. And one of my favorite things to say is rocket science isn't the hardest thing I've done. It's not the hardest thing I've seen in my own professional career. And people love that. Like, what do you mean by that? And it facilitates more of a conversation. So past that, the reason why is because I recognize a lot of my colleagues and a lot of the work we did after you got your degree was disconnected from people in their complicated problems, their wicked problems, right?
Yeah,
from
yeah.
society, from environmental, ecological, or economic concerns, from I needed my work to have a soul. That's the phrase I've been saying for a while. And yeah. I came across, I knew I was going to PhD, and it gave me the space to find disciplines, communities, relationships that I could combine what I didn't know with other disciplines that I could dive into. And those became the three that I described before.
Right.
Got the PhD. The Botswana point that you mentioned is interesting because my main topic of my dissertation was the Botswana innovation ecosystem.
Okay. Right. That's well done for managing to have the one liner, by the way. You know, people say, what's your PhD about? It's like, well, there's a kind of one sentence version of this, and then there's a 100,000 word version. There's nothing in between.
Hey, it gets people invested because you say, what does that mean? And then we could dive into the rest of what it's about, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But that happened. Also, the real reason why I'm here is because I got married, because my wonderful wife is from here.
Nice.
We've been building a house, building a life here as well. And a lot of the work that I've done, yes, back in the States, but in here, was about extending and supporting the research that I did while I was in the process of finishing the terminal degree.
Yeah.
So a lot of my work has been about, the way I like to characterize it, is helping people help people.
Nice.
So it's been social change makers, some of them being technological designers, some of them being political leaders or community activists. They have a gripe with the world that they're trying to deal with, struggle against, and they know, they might know what the future looks like. They might know different tactics that they want to use to get there, but they might not have all of the knowledge resources to support that endeavor, whether it be ones influenced by human-centered design, design thinking, whether it be influenced by evaluation, systems thinking. Obviously, Shira Kababa is our mutual connection. And I try to not introduce them to, yeah, look at this field or look at that topic. It's, you're trying to get there. Did you know this framework might help? Did you know this is a way that you could think about this issue, a way you can connect or collaborate with these topics or engage in research in a useful manner to reach the end of your journey? No, let me help you. Let me teach you. Let me collaborate on what that could look like. So it's been a lot of that.
There's a thing you just said there that I really, really like that I want to pick up on, which is frameworks. I sometimes kind of rag on product folks, and they're friends of mine too, but because of the sort of service product tension thing. But yeah, they themselves talk about how, you know, product managers and product people love a framework and love a kind of, and it can easily morph into, being dogmatic about, this is the way to do a thing, this is how you do this method, this is what these artifacts, like, you know, journey maps or vision statements or roadmaps or whatever, need to look like, and so on. And you said a thing there, did you know there's a way to help you think about this differently? And I really like that as a way of framing any new methods or any new method, you know, because you can get in deep into systems thinking and it can all be about the, you know, the kind of diagramming methods and stuff like that of systems thinking, and kind of lose the whole point of it. And I think, you know, reading someone like Donella Meadows, who's got this really lovely way of, I think, of writing about thinking in systems, which is the name of her book, isn't it? You know, it's a way of shifting your mental model of the world, which I really like. So I'm really glad you kind of said it like that.
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of work with different folks and learning from them in fields that I haven't been rigorously trained in. For instance, the strategic foresight and futurology community, the AI and ethics community, AI and equity community. And a core quality for how they introduce the value of their field is, humans do this already all the time.
Yeah.
I've heard that phrase consistently, right? The idea being that if you are a professional in a knowledge-based discipline or industry, that there's importance to the craft of doing it right and making sure that it makes sense. And I sense that tension that you just described, right? Of rigor versus practicality. And in many ways, this will get into a deeper conversation about my problems with HCD, of which I have many, but I'm much more leaning on the importance of practicality when wielding these methods, because making sure that we humans in all of our connections make sense of and can use the tools, whether it's how to create the world, how to evaluate the world, how to imagine a future, a way that affects everyone instead of stays in the silos, stays in the the pieces of industry or academia that none of us can reach.
Yeah. I think part of that, though, is also this idea of the map is not the territory, right? This
yes.
The methods and methodologies, they're all very useful because they are, they help you usually understand complexity or complex things in a kind of simpler way. But in order to do so, like a real map, it's an abstraction, right? If you have, there's the famous, I don't know if it's a kind of tale or a kind of thing about the philosophers who wanted to create a map that was as detailed as possible. And they ended up with a map that was so detailed, it overlaid the territory, right? It was because it's one-to-one. And so all maps, and you look at, when you zoom out on like Google Maps, you see there's different levels of abstraction it goes through. At one level of zoom on a city, you don't see all the tiny alleyways, or you don't see the names of those things, right? And you keep zooming out and you just see the major roads and so forth. And I think, I talk about, this is why this podcast is called Power of 10, is, this idea of kind of zooming in and out and being aware, though, of the abstraction you're doing at that moment. And you're doing it deliberately because you can't think about everything all at once, or you can't talk about everything all at once, because you can kind of end up in that whole, oh, we're just kind of boiling the ocean conversation and kind of get nowhere. And so you do need those levels of abstraction. But I think what happens quite often is people forget that that's what's going on, right? That they think that I mean, you see it in economics all the time, right? There's a whole lot of economists who are going, no, we're really going into a recession in the US, which isn't. And I go, no, but the model said we're going into a recession, and all the indicators are actually saying no. And it's like they can't handle the fact that their Chicago economics models don't match what's actually going on in the world. And I think this happens all the time. I think there's a thing here that we could probably segue into the HCD thing, which also happens, right? Where you kind of, those methods of human-centered design, which have been, incredibly useful in many respects to bring a lot more, human-centered thinking into the design studio, a lot more sort of outside-in thinking, certain type of outside-in thinking to the design studio, but also is obviously brings with it abstractions that have made or design, I would say, sort of blind to a whole lot of other areas, not least the fact that it's very Northern Hemisphere, US, white-centric, tell me your feelings about human-centered design, Dr. OG.
Oh, I have many. I have a lot. All models are wrong, some models are useful, right? And the question becomes, trying to use it for, right? So let me start with discussing my pedigree, right? Some people won't even listen if they don't think that you've had experience in the topic, in the field. And when I started my PhD, one of the core questions I dove into first was a collection of papers on human-centered design for development.
Yeah.
We tried, and in certain ways, I mean, the failed is a complex phrase, right? We fail forward, right?
Yeah.
We did our best to try and amalgamate all of the different assets that recorded human-centered design processes in peer-reviewed publications. At the time, I think it was like 2013 or so, had lasted for a while. And there was a lot of diversity and experience and thought and background and implementation. And I say that to say I'm glad that I was trained in what it was supposed to do and what people had done to wield it across a lot of different development spaces. And at the same time, I'm also appreciative a year or so later that I engaged with and continue to go down the path of critiquing design as a whole, human-centered design being a part of that. I think a incredibly powerful resource that I came across, designers love being interdisciplinary, so I'm going to bring in a discipline that knocks them on their ass just a little bit. there's a course that came out during early COVID, when the West still believed in it, right? It's called Modernity and Coloniality by Ahmed Ansari. I believe I know he's a professor in New York, exactly which university, not quite sure. He's moved around a bit, I believe. But the course was built for designers to start discussing structures, frameworks for how the world has been built, that design fits inside and must understand if it is to see the world through its through many different true perspectives. One of the main points is influenced by the field of world systems theory.
Yeah,
they try to understand the world as it has been constructed in larger societies as a whole. One point they make is the Portuguese did a lot to mess things up, like create the idea of stratified racism as a caste structure that.
Yeah.
But the core asset that they use, the framework that we orchestrate across many different ways that we engage with our world, they call the center-periphery model. The idea being that when mercantilism started and they built and took resources, whether it's gold, whether it's people, whether it's ideas, back to the crown to help increase the wealth of that empire that was then replicated by many other empires to compete with each other. That process of construction was replicated across many, many different ways of how humans engage with life. That means economic systems, labor systems, political systems, educational systems. You see a center and a periphery, and many that includes race, gender, sexuality, class. And also that includes the creative industries, specifically design, right? So the main way that it represents itself in how we operate is a collection of rarefied designers that have had a particular type of experience that engage with community, that connect with a type of abstractified design that is separate from craft, that where people can buy associate, they can operate, they can see, like, for instance, in Botswana, they can engage with herbs like Sengapadile, Devil's Claw, and Hudia. They can connect with those entities, research them, come back and say, these are ideas that can help benefit the rest of the world. Steal them, turn them into and support multinational corporate profit, and specifically medicines and herbs that the people who've been raising and engaging with those resources for hundreds of years get very minimal benefit from, if not their lives become markedly harder because then they're affected by the economic system of that thing prioritizing how they live their lives, right?
Yeah.
So in that process, design becomes a translator for people with power. Like, this thing was good. Now we can expand it and make it larger and more innovative so that some people can make money off of it and can shift the economic structure of how the world operates. It becomes a place that creates a hierarchy for a type of creation. It universalizes. If you don't do it like HCD, then it's not really truly a design method, or similar to other methods that have come before or ones that critique it afterwards, right? It becomes the main fuel or maybe engine for how humans see future coming. It is, the future is here because these new innovations are happening more quickly than culture can understand and recognize. And because it's harder for humans to adapt and understand, let the people who understand it and can build it hold power over what the future can become. And that is that's a collection of power in many ways that people don't reconcile with and isn't leveraged for the ways that humans are still designing outside of those paradigms.
If I was to sort of crassly summarize, and I think it probably is a crass summary, because I think you're making quite a, or several kind of interconnected and quite subtle arguments, but are you saying that, you know, one aspect of, say, human-centered design is it's become this kind of monolith that is, it feels like, we forget that it's an invented methodology and way of thinking and system, and just think, well, that's just the way things are, just in the same way as we kind of assume capitalism is, well, that's just the way things are, right? Or corporations, which are actually a relatively young entity in human terms, are just that's the way things work. And that therefore allows for, or excuses lots of dubious behaviors with a kind of shrug of like, well, you know, that's just the way it is. And that designers, through that kind of shrug, collective shrug, have not really engaged with the undercurrents of power structures in the, you know, the work that they're doing, and have either kind of wittingly but kind of turning a blind eye to, or sort of unwittingly become just tools of those power plays, you know, whether that is a very sort of colonial, you know, you talked about the sort of pharma industry, whether that's a sort of business colonialism or whether it is actual colonialism.
That's definitely a part of it. So there are a lot of themes and qualities to how oppressive structures replicate themselves, right? One of them being it's universalized.
Yeah.
People attach and they recognize a business sense, a hierarchy sense of how a part of society should live. In this situation, it's creative industries. It is innovation industries. And the way becomes the way that, like, you innovate, you ideate, you prototype, you problem find towards particular issues. And the people with power recognize how it fits, aligns with their interests, and spread it across the world. And in many ways, it is a epistemicide of other ways that people create and evolve towards other ends and means. Particular instance, human-centered design is very much, it can be easily aligned with scaling a particular product once you know that it's the thing that makes sense, right? So what about ways of creation and adaptability and creativity that aren't about scale, that aren't about necessarily making money, might be about disrupting how people operate so that they can live better and easier lives.
Yeah.
But additionally, it's also about building a hierarchy that puts humans on top. This is the easier one.
Yeah, sure.
Human-centered design.
Yeah, no, there's been quite a lot about the shift from that to...
Yeah, very much so.
You know, planet-centered, life-centered design. You know.
My favorite article a couple of years back, might be a decade back now, it's called Bee-Centered Design.
As in being-centered or as in bees?
As in bees, the animal that flies around.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're crucial to everything.
Right? Essential, very much so. And it's valuable and representative for humans to engage not just only in a type of empathy for how they operate and how they will build things to benefit their perspective of identity, but a solidarity for the living things that we are a part of and we do not lord over, right?
Yeah.
So it's a lot there, and there are a lot of other pieces to it. I think the core thing is recognizing that there are humans and other living things have exercise agency over things they create in the world in ways that are valuable and necessary. Mm. And human-centered design is not the only way to do it, but the people that evangelize it act like it is. And
yeah, okay,
that's important.
So I want to ask you, sort of try and kind of make a practical question for this, because there's obviously been a large amount of, you know, it's not always white. It certainly is mostly sort of Northern Hemisphere designer as savior stuff that's gone on in using kind of human-centered design. I mean, some of the case studies that you read are, you know, literally are these poor people in Africa, in select whatever African country you want, were having a problem with this thing. And we came along and kind of interviewed them and, you know, did some pseudo-ethnography for kind of a week or two. And came, designed the solution, and you know, look how much better we've made their lives. And, you know, I've made a very crass version of that, but there are more subtle versions of that. And there are people who are doing good work. There are people who are kind of trying to do good work, and in general, I think for most designers, it comes from a good place, right? At least, you know, psychologically, or, you know, comes from the heart, that stuff of like, I want to, a lot of designers get into design because they want to make a positive impact in the world. And so, you know, I see it amongst my students quite a lot too, actually. You know, this along my master's students, you know, they all want to kind of save the world, right? And society. And they kind of slip into this thing all the time. From your both your experience and your understanding of this, how can they kind of escape that trap, still be involved in doing work that is impactful and positive, at the same time as not kind of slipping into this kind of savior syndrome?
I'm going to tell you a few stories.
Please do.
That really resonate with me on that point. Some of them are from my own experience. Some of them are from my favorite books on the topic. The theme that I'm trying to wrap around into, we'll see if I succeed, because I love going too deep, is how much is your ego replicated across your areas of influence?
Right.
So first story is mine. I came into Botswana first as a part of a program called the International Development Design Summit, funded by USAID, run by MIT, some of the folks doing the best type of participatory design at the time, all around the world, dozens of different interventions built, thousands, if not tens of thousands of people involved in the program, millions of dollars spent across the world to help benefit locally designed and testable and repairable interventions to help development, right?
Yeah.
We built a deep sand wheelchair. It is the gold star project. I like to say, get people saying, oh, maybe I should listen to what he's saying. I consider the intervention a failure. Here's why. 3 weeks of design and 1 week of what happens next. And we all decided collectively, like the practical decision based on what made sense in the intervention, meaning this is a potential business. It is a thing that needs health professionals involved. And development officials involved as well, that there was an institutional void separated from the people that had the issue that we were trying to address and the resources to help continue to evolve this project. So they decided we could try and send it to Zambia. We could send it to Michigan State. We could send it to some wheelchair specialists in different places. We effectively had to leave the communities that asked for the problem in the first place for years and years on end before any intervention, any value could actually come from what we were constructing for safety, for business, for a lot of different understandable but struggling purposes. Afterwards, a core part that came out of my research was 2 years of studying what had happened in that town, in that village after we came and before we were there. And a lot of reckoning with the type of ways that we engaged in design, as much as we tried to collaborate, engage in power-laden participatory design activities. What did I learn? A lot of things happened before us, number one. Number two, there was, I think a phrase that we can use here is, especially for people coming in and out that were development specialists, that were brought there because there was a development cycle of folks that could continue to bring them little, if not no learning about what had happened before and what continued to happen. Number three, there was no recognition of the political and historical things that we couldn't address using our design expertise. Specifically, we're dealing with the San community, some of the most highest, the most researched indigenous communities that anyone has ever experienced, because they're the direct line from where all humans descended from, right? Which gets into story number two. That idea that so much of what we're building, what we discuss, and what happened at the end were highlighted absolutely by us trying to do good, trying our best and engaging with communities in which they say it was useful and beneficial, what have you, but at its core did not make systemic change across many different projects, many different ideas to address the direct issues that we didn't even have the power and capacity to do so. Which hits into another point that you described. designers are not the first people to do this type of interventionist activity. No. And like, it's even we talked a little bit about people doing things well versus people like engaging with a lot of people doing this. You said quasi-ethnography. Anthropologists, by design, in the creation of their field, went into San communities for years and years on end and did things like measure the size of their genitals and connected with them, required to stay with them in particular ways and characterize and officialize their culture as a particular thing through their own definitions and clarifications of what ethnography should look like, not quasi, the gold standard of ethnography to represent and determine, one, this is what this world is like based on our perspective, and not just individuals, like the Western perspective of what makes sense to live like. Number two, officialize how they operate that then influences national governance strategies, definitely in Botswana and all across the world in different ways that people do this type of activity. And overall, fail to recognize the culture, the perspective, the agency, and the needs of this community, either when they started in the world, but then afterwards. So when things started changing based on design interventions, international development interventions, innovation interventions, it's a big thing that keeps happening. And that these are larger stories about the history of these types of activities to get to that larger point that so much of our professional activities and how we operate trying to do social change is wrapped up in our egos. And I don't only mean egos in terms of like an individual mind state of how you operate with someone. I mean the ego of an organization, the ego of nations, the ego of the West as a whole, basically separating and identifying itself as the valuable way to go, the one way, the top way, the center.
Mm-hmm. How can we get everyone else to come to where we are?
Effectively, essentially, right? And design very much so buys into that, human-centered design especially. But this is a quality of how Western society has decided to construct itself that we all have to, are not bound, but immensely compelled to play by its rules, right? So it's very, I'm saying that to make sure people recognize the enormity of that task. How do you get your ego out of this type of work? Because in many ways, a lot of students recognize, if I don't do this, then I won't succeed. They have to play by the game, even if they might not want to, right? So there's a fantastic book I keep talking about that dives into how hard that might be to accomplish. The book is called Hospicing Modernity by the Gesturing Towards Futures Collective, Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures Collective.
Okay.
And it's a very hard task. There are a few resources that they suggest, but it takes a lot of hard work to be able to use them effectively to get out of your own head and recognize how you're connected with the larger system.
All right. So this is one of the things I was going to come back to, because as you were talking, I was thinking that, I mean, there's a lot there.
Yeah.
But there is a, you know, when you talk about the ego thing, I can hear the kind of, I want to do something socially impactful. I want to do something, I want to do good, right? And there's obviously a kind of altruistic aspect to that, but there's also kind of, I want to feel good about myself. I want to feel like my life has purpose. Now, I don't necessarily think those two things need to be, crushed, because, you can obviously end up doing good stuff as well when it comes to, I prefer that to kind of, I want to make loads of money and screw anyone else, right? Or we want to move fast and break things, and scale as big as possible and all that kind of stuff. And, there is just to sort of go back to, one bit, I guess your point there is this idea of like, know your history, or at least respect what is there, and, go and find out and respect what's there, even if you say, oh, that's all kind of rubbish and we're going to do something new. But I think there's a difference between being kind of looking what's gone before and kind of deciding we're going to make a break from that to just being ignorant of what's come before.
Yeah.
Those are two very different kind of ways of looking. And I think what happens quite often in, actually in design studies in general, even if we're doing something for like kind of retail shopping center in, you know, in Australia, the design teams often don't bother to go and have a look at the literature because people have been studying kind of retail habits and the psychology of shopping and, you know, consumerism, all mm-hmm. that for decades. We're not very good as a discipline, I think. And maybe a human-centered design is part of the, it's a blame for this because it sort of sets primary research as the kind of primary, you know, number one thing. And whereas, you know, say in sort of peace development, security, kind of that kind of world, the literature is the thing, right? Best practice from, you know, this area and this, what the UN did here, and, you know, which is not often best practice, but nevertheless, that's the literature, right? And I think that, you know, design has been pretty bad at kind of knowing its history, kind of even within design, actually, yeah. but knowing its history beyond design. It's not very good at starting there. It's like, what have other people had to say about this thing? And part of it, I think, is this idea that, you know, the beginner's mindset, we want to come in as with yes. fresh views. And in fact, what we're trying to do is have that break. In order to be innovative and new, we need to have that kind of break and not be influenced by that stodgy old stuff that's just been kind of, you know, repeating the same loop.
Tabula rasa.
Yeah, right. But at the same time, then you kind of are doomed. I mean, you see it quite often where sort of design teams come in to something like in kind of, you know, peace development security, and they say, well, what about if we do this? And everyone kind of there rolls their eyes and go, yeah, you know, we've been trying to do this for years. There must, on the other hand, there is an advantage to fresh eyes. There is something that brings of kind of, as you said, do you know there's a different way of thinking about this? There's a methodology, there's a mindset, a different way of kind of thinking about this problem that is different from the one that has been repeated many times. And there feels to me like there's, you know, there must be a balance to be had there. And I don't know if it's about getting rid of the ego as it is, as rather than the self-reflexivity, you know, recognizing that, okay, that's there. It's not going to go away. You can't really get rid of your ego. And in fact, my wife as a psychologist would say it's a very important thing, but there's about understanding where that is and in the context of which you're operating, there seems to be the work to be done.
We might anger some LSD researchers, right? Some shrooms researchers, but maybe you can't get rid of that ego as you're operating in these spaces. Like, the ego has a purpose, right? Yes. It was created to ensure humans can develop and recognize where they are, what they offer, what they can, what agency they hold, and what matters in their life as they're becoming adults, as they're becoming
full. Yeah, right. It's also the thing that helps you make the break. You know, that's why the terrible twos and threes.
Very much so.
It helps you make the break from the kind of the parent, particularly the mother, usually. As you know, because up until then, you were just kind of part of a whole with your parents. Yeah, and
very much so. And it, I think, a core thing to recognize is if you're doing one thing, you're not doing another thing, right? So tabula rasa has those. Beginner's mindset, starting mm-hmm. from scratch, recognizing what's there, has value and is also deeply, grossly over-prioritized in recognizing the value of innovative thinking, right? Because it also has a history in colonialism as a concept, the idea that terra nullius.
I was about to say exactly that. I lived in Australia for a long time, right?
Boom. It's there. We all see the qualities and parts of it, and recognizing it's what it does, the consequences of utilizing it and trying to hedge those for the future is a valuable endeavor. But also it's the struggle is recognizing as you're trying to navigate your ego, as you're trying to figure out where do I sit when trying to do this type of work, is you definitely have to know, what am I getting out of this? Why does it matter to me? Who am I carrying as I do this type of work? Who's driving the bus, right? And who are my yeah. passengers? Who's my shadow self? What are the identities that make me feel excited or frustrated or defensive or insecure when I get influenced by these types of things, right? Because mm-hmm. those... If The other problem with move fast and break things is you get any opportunity to reflect on those struggles is fuck it. We got shit to do. We got to move fast. That's the struggle, right? There's a lot there, and the struggle is while doing that hard work of recognizing what influences you as you're trying to engage in any type of social change, whether you're an evaluator or a researcher, you're a designer, you are a systems thinker, you're a futures thinker, right? Number one, how much of you are you bringing into that space? So you have to get to know you very well. That becomes a constant practice. But also recognizing I'm not sure that you'll be able to separate yourself from what you're trying to accomplish, but valuing and engaging with what other people, other living things also bring to those spaces that then could create unexpected, valuable, and very interesting ways to shape our world.
Yeah, well, there's a thing I've often talked about design or designers, you know, in sort of corporate spaces, actually, which is this need for a kind of balance between ego and humility, you know, because you do need, it is a practice, you know, where basically you look at the world and go, that thing could be better. This isn't as good as it could be. And I've got an idea of how it could be better. And I'm going to kind of make a thing. Or I'm going to create a thing. And to bring this thing into the world and manifest it. And so there's a kind of certain amount of ego involved in that I think you actually need. Right? At the same time, there's a humility that you need to have to be open to, you know, critique and change and feedback and all those sort of things, but also the history and the context and, you know, what have other people done? What have non-designers done in this? Or, you know, what design have people who have not called themselves designers, but what design have those people done? That you need. And it's a kind of constant back and forth, I think. And, you know, we have the star designers occasionally, and then that becomes the sort of, you know, the auteur designer, particularly in the 90s, there was a lot of that. And you can kind of also go the other way, though, I think, where you can kind of end up in kind of like a paralysis, you know. And I see it actually quite often in design teams when they feel like, I see it in students all the time, where they feel like, I just need a little bit more research, because at some point, it's like, I'm going to get to the point where the end users or the, you know, whoever is going to be using this thing, whoever I'm researching, is going to tell me what I have to design and to sort of end up in a kind of designer by numbers thing. If I just get enough research, it's going to, you know, it's going to tell me what I need to do. But there is a bit, that never happens, right? There is a bit in the middle where you do have to take that leap and go, okay, I think, you know, hypothesis-driven designs, I believe, you know, that this thing is going to, you know, help in some way. But obviously you need to build in that sense and respond, that feedback loop to go, oh, okay, that I was wrong about that. What I think is, I mean, I you talk about sort of ACD, the thing that bugs me the most is this obsession with speed and velocity as a kind of de facto a good thing. Because I actually think it's that, you know, the move fast and break things, it's not so much the breaking things, it's the lack of reflection on what you've broken. That's the problem. It's the moving fast bit, as if like you can break things, but if you don't care about what you've broken, that's problematic. And if you're going really fast, it's like, oh, that's in the past, right? And the tech industry in particular has got like a collective amnesia, you know, it's got a kind of memory that is not much longer than about 6 months. I was just talking to someone yesterday who was talking about how 6 months ago there was a massive flood of they work for an AI startup, you know, AI kind of driven startup, you know, 6 months ago. So we're at the beginning of middle of September as we're talking about this. 6 months ago, there was a kind of investors were throwing money at anything with AI. And he said, actually, in the last 3 months, that's kind of dried up again because, you know, they'll be on to the next big thing or whatever. And, you know, that speed, I think, is a problem. And when you think about, you know, the sort of, I mean, I talked before about how corporations are relatively young in the kind of history of human culture, right? The idea of this entity, this legal entity in many cases, that has been created to actually give cover to all sorts of murderous and terrible activities. You know, the problem we have, I guess, collectively in the world is that very short-term memory and thinking and understanding of humans in the world, right? And I think that plays out in all sorts of different kind of scales, you know, both in, you know, I just talked about the tech industry, but I think it also you can think about human-centered design, you can think about sort of design for social impact and change and those kinds of things that even when we think in terms of decades, that's still very, very short. Design actually really struggles to operate in a kind of long-term, with a sort of long-term point of view.
Yes, very much so. There's a lot there. This is the problem. Each one of us is saying something that has a lot that we could buy into.
Yeah, so, it has a lot in there.
So
yeah.
I'm gonna pose a collection of questions to problematize, right? To expand, okay. Based on what you said. I heard ego. I heard short-term perspectives. I heard a lot of pieces. What comes to mind is, for instance, when we create things, when we ideate and create things, we operate in many ways in the same rationalities that replicates how we show up in the world that might hurt others. So, for instance, what if when you come up with an idea or an intervention that goes out into the world, what if you could build structures that separate the ownership of your idea or the thing you built from the thing and how it operates in society, right? So what if you could see yourself instead of separate from the thing that's being, that is the problem with society, that you could see yourself as a part of it. You are moved, you are shaped by it, you're molded by it, and you see the problems even inside yourself and others. So you become an active agent in addressing those things without thinking that I do it because I know better, but I do it because there is a need. And that hits on the third point that I wanted to potentially ask about, the idea of what if design as a field, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. A core quality is interdisciplinarily, holistically, working through the need of humans to address a particular problem using novel, creative, unique solutions. So what if that need has other influences besides humans? How do you listen for? How do you gain feedback from those other entities to determine how that fits instead of the denying of the externalities that affect how we engage with many different cultures, many different industries, saying this is what matters, whether it's the market, whether it's population, whether it's who's winning the next election, what have you, but how things are going to react and live in our society this generation, seven generations, a while back, not long, long, long term, like the long termists, right, like to talk about, but what would it look like for you to do design where you listen to that extent and then build things that shape a more healthy system or structures in society? A lot of things to think about, but I think they're worth it.
It puts the sort of 2-week design sprint into perspective.
It does.
I mean, it does. I mean, I think it, you know, I'm going to sound just like sort of kids get off my lawn, but I think a lot of the world's ills are down to us wanting just to go as fast as possible all the time. You know, I really think it's an issue.
Very much so.
So listen, we're coming up to time. We're easily coming up to time. It's going to be a long one, but that's okay. I like it. Tell me about Moving Beyond.
Sure. I'll tell you about a great colleague that I met just over a year ago, Aparna Ray, who built the organization from the ground up. Their focus being on diversity, equity, inclusion, and data, recognizing the value of building equitable spaces by what you can measure, what you can track, what becomes applicable. We found each other. We were kindred spirits. We were both nerds in these topics. And we said, we've had weird careers. We want to build a course. What should it be? If we went down this path of supporting equitable social change 10 years ago, we wanted to build a course that made it more valuable, more efficient, more about the issue instead of about our egos. What course would we make? And then we made it. We call it Equity Intuition. We are running real close up to the deadline where the actual convenings are starting September 26th. It's a 6-week convening, not 2 weeks, 6 weeks, a little bit more time. But It's our baby. We put a lot of time, we are putting a lot of time and energy into the frameworks, resources, the experiences, the issues that people are bringing into those spaces to try and work through with other people, other troublemakers that have gripes about equitable concerns in the world. And it's very much so influenced by design thinking methods, through systems thinking methods, and through people that have critiqued those fields as well. What we all agree on and recognize is there's a lot of shit wrong with how the world operates. And we see the importance, both our organizations and individuals, in funding and supporting capacity building to help recognize how to draw the map, right?
Yeah.
But how to have other people critique the map, take the path, and figure out what the vision should be on the other side. So we're glad to talk about it.
So what kind of people are you hoping to get in to this? And what are you hoping will be the outcomes of it?
Troublemakers. We want troublemakers. We want, we have some political organizers. We have some innovation consultants, folks that help build for large for-profits and the like. We have people inside organizations. We have folks that have been recently let go because of the world in which we live, that all come with. The first thing that we ask people, and we did in our LinkedIn lives and what have you, is we ask, what is your gripe? You might not have a problem space yet. You might not have a, how might we? Definitely not the plan after you get through that, but you definitely have, this is fucking wrong, and I can't quite describe why. Maybe even a feeling of the issue that you're dealing with. And you have the resources, you have the important community that can help you support putting that gripe into strategic practice, into, you want to figure out how to make, chart a path towards an equitable issue inside your organization, with your community, with a particular technological problem, in a different country where people are helicoptering in and out with design interventions, right? You want that? Come here.
Okay. So these are, they don't have to be designers. They don't have to be any flavor.
Most of them aren't.
Anyone. Most of them aren't.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool. So, well, I'll put the links in the show notes.
Thank you very much.
But it is, it's movingbeyond.co.co /lab. Yes.
Yes.
Is the where the course is. Okay. And it's, when you say it's starting, you said it was starting the 26th
of September in 2 weeks.
26th of September. Okay. All right. So people can sign up there. Now, I have a last question for every guest, and your task is going to be to come up with a short answer to this. Power of 10 is named after the Eames film, the Ray and Charles Eames film called Powers of 10. It's about the relative size of things in the universe. And I talk a lot about kind of zoom levels. I talked in the introduction from, you know, could be some UI small thing to kind of change a lot. What one small thing is either overlooked or should be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
Directed practical compassion. These are slightly different topics and ideas, but favorite quote, justice is what love looks like in public.
Nice.
We're having virtual meetings all over the place, right? A lot of my folks are back in the States or in other places outside of Botswana. And these people are smart. These people are tired. These people see a struggle that they're trying to deal with in their own lives or in the rest of the world. And they come ready to brandish their guns of their pedigrees, of their work, of what they think should be accomplished, of what makes sense as we move forward. And I realized something I've been trying to practice in every single meeting I have is compliment them somehow. For instance, I'm just appreciative. What I love about our conversation, number one, we can go back and forth, we can connect, we can debate about these topics, but what I really appreciate, number one, other than your beard, so I'm trying to get your beard one of these days, the color.
I appreciate shape. Yours.
But what I appreciate is the openness and the succinctness at which you try to engage with what I'm bringing to our discussions so that it can become a more productive space for any designer, whether or not you believe or not in human-centered design, to question and collaborate how to build things better. And I can see that you've done that in other conversations, and I'm excited that, this becomes a space for collaboration. What I just did is compliment you and professionalized beings in our society don't use that as a tactical measure to engage with humans, to lower their defenses, to connect with things about what happens in their society, and to move together as a collaborative. If you're kind with people, then they might not want to give you shit and recognize we're all in this together on this earth to build and move and evolve. So a small little thing is try to be kind with someone else so you can recognize how you can work with them.
Well, Pierce, Dr. OG, I appreciate your magnificent thinking and everything you brought to this conversation and your time. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to me, Andy Pullane, on Power of 10. You can find me at apullane on pkm.social, on Mastodon, apullane on Twitter, or go to pullane.com, where you can find more episodes, check out my coaching practice and online courses, as well as sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. As you know, it tickles the algorithms and helps more people find the podcast. As always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.